command of the night brigade. I was hoping the plane and crossed by the rain, and I walked on a crooked crutch.
Hey, Matt Rothschild here, sitting in for Maggie Dawn. I'll be back tomorrow. I'm the former editor at the Progressive Magazine and was executive director at the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. And I'm delighted to have you listen in with me today, because here in the studio, in the Waukesha studio here on Wisconsin Avenue, I have Jim Sentell, who's got this terrific program on the weekends on civic media, where he goes into great detail on some of the most important court cases facing the country. And he spent a lot of time, obviously, over the last couple of years dealing with these suits against Donald Trump. And I thought I'd bring him in here to talk about this big decision this morning by the U.S. Supreme Court on this question as to whether states can take Donald Trump off the ballot because he's an insurrectionist. Jim, what did you make of the decision?
And Matt, first, I'm delighted to be with you, my friend. Great to be here in an important day in American history. Once again, we have a lot of these days now in our lifetimes, right?
Too many.
Exactly, exactly. This is another one. This wasn't a surprise, as you and I have discussed. We knew from the oral arguments of a number of weeks ago that the majority, in this case, a unanimous Supreme Court, was not going to buy into this notion that Donald Trump would be thrown off the primary ballot in Colorado. But there's certainly a difference of opinion out there among judges. We recall that there was a trial in this case. And the lower court, the trial court, actually found not only was there an insurrection, but that Donald Trump participated in it. The judge then went on to find this kind of crazy thing that, in fact, he's not an official. And for that reason, the 14th Amendment doesn't apply. It goes up to the Colorado Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court buys into everything but the last of those propositions. Says, oh, yes, of course, under the 14th Amendment, the president of the United States of America is indeed an official. Insurrection happened. Donald Trump is responsible for it. Throws him off the ballot. That's what gets us before the Supreme Court. And again, we have this oral argument that exhausts all of these other arguments, which we can also chat about, having to do with what is an official, all kinds of things out there. In the end, it was fairly clear, and everything everybody was predicting ever since that oral argument, the Supreme Court would say, no, we're putting you back on the ballot. And that's exactly what they did today, a unanimous decision, 9-0. Important that they do that. A 9-0 opinion is a significant thing. Plainly, they got to it in a little different way. They all agreed on the result. But at least five of them went on to talk about what the legislature is supposed to do.
Yeah, speaking with Jim Sentell, former federal prosecutor, civil litigator, criminal defense attorney, too, a lot of hats, and great program that he has here on civic media on the weekends. They didn't get to the question as to whether Trump was an insurrectionist. The Colorado lower court, as you said, and the Colorado Supreme Court said he was an insurrectionist. They just kind of punted on that.
They absolutely did. There's nothing there. They're not coming close to that. And they probably had lots of discussions about how this should play out. Judges and justices, as you know, Matt, have a tendency to decide cases in the narrowest possible viewpoint. And they chose here, obviously, majority of them, to say that the case will be decided on this notion that states don't have the obligation, the responsibility at all. Only the Congress can do that. We are not going to get into a discussion about whether there was sufficient evidence at the trial court to support the notion that their number one was an insurrection, that number two, Donald Trump, was its author, its creator, if you will. They came nowhere near that. And that will also be the subject of a lot of commentary, obviously, going forward as we think about what happened today.
Now, all nine of the justices seem to agree that they had to decide this way because otherwise there'd be chaos.
Right.
If one state used some evidence to say he's disqualified or made a determination that he was disqualified and another state did the opposite, there would be chaos. So there was unanimity on that one. There wasn't unanimity on the question as to whether Congress has to define what constitutes insurrection or what constitutes disqualification. In fact, there was a pointed dissent by the three liberal justices just on this question. Did that surprise you? And what were they saying?
You know, it did not surprise me, just because, again, these are justices, including, again, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson, and Amy Coney Barrett. That's the four. Those are the four who say, you know what, you don't need to do this. They look down the bench and they said, the other five of you, you don't need to do this at all. Why are you doing this? And so I think that the word coming out from this concurring but sort of dissenting opinion is just very telling. Although federal enforcement of Section 3 is in no way at issue, the majority announces today a novel rule for how that enforcement must operate. They go on to say it reaches out, they're talking about the majority, reaches out to decide Section 3 questions not before us, and to foreclose future efforts to disqualify a presidential candidate under that provision in a sensitive case, crying out for judicial restraint, it, meaning the other five, you folks who create the unanimous opinion, it abandons that course. That's pretty strong language, saying that you don't have to do this, and yet you did, and pretty much it's not our place, the four of them are saying. It's not our place to tell how this should be implemented, and they plainly also want to leave open the prospect that there could be other mechanisms for enforcement. Right before we got on the air, you and I were chatting about this case out of New Mexico, where you got a judge who found that somebody who was found guilty of an insurrectionist behavior throws that person off the ballot. Those kinds of things, they wanted to leave that open. Supreme Court today says, nope, only the federal Congress. Matt, as you just accurately said, only the Congress has the responsibility, the authority to make those calls.
Yeah, the liberal justices suggested that a judge could throw out a prosecution if it was coming from someone who was elected who was an insurrectionist. Here's the sentence that I caught. It forecloses judicial enforcement of that provision, such as might occur when a party is prosecuted by an insurrectionist and raises a defense of that at trial. And so that was kind of interesting. I hadn't thought about that. What would that be if Trump or Trump's attorney general is prosecuting someone? The defendant, according to the liberal justices, could have raised the argument that, look, this guy doesn't even belong there. Right. How can he prosecute me for this?
Exactly. Your kind of legitimacy question. Where does this come from? And that's exactly right. There are an awful lot of things that they talk about in this opinion. That is the four that I think make great sense. And that's one of them. Justices always think about the consequences. And here you can make the argument based upon that language that what the majority, again, the five member of the unanimous court today, what they have done is pretty much narrowed that possibility. And so in that sense, it does not give the breadth of enforcement option that you just described from that language. We know as well that there are other states out there that are also looking at this. This comes out of Colorado, obviously. Just last week, we had Illinois. We had a judge there who said, we're throwing Donald Trump off the ballot. Maine has been waiting around. So all of these things, all those people in all those states, including right here in Wisconsin, are going to be parsing through this opinion and saying, okay, apparently, according to the Supreme Court, the 14th Amendment does mean something, but only the Congress needs to enact this implementing legislation. We need to hold off until we do something, until we get that implementing legislation.
And the Wisconsin cases are being withdrawn right now, I see.
Absolutely.
Right. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm subbing in here for Maggie Dawn. He'll be back tomorrow. I'm speaking with Jim Santel, former federal prosecutor and great host of this really intelligent show on the weekends about all the court challenges and court cases that are facing us and what they bode for our democracy and the future of our democracy. You know, the three liberals in their concurring opinion, because it was a unanimous opinion, and I agree it's important, it's unanimous, but they also said that there may be some federal statutes, mm-hmm. other than just a judge deciding, some federal statutes that are now being foreclosed upon that some person at trial could call on to say, look, this person's an insurrectionist. This is the line that I saw. The decision by the five in the majority, not including Amy Coney Barrett and the liberals, rules out enforcement under general federal statutes requiring the government to comply with the law. Now, I'm not a lawyer. My dad was a lawyer. I've got three brothers who are lawyers, and a grandfather was a lawyer. But what federal statutes were they trying to suggest?
Sure, there are all kinds of things. Again, you still have to go back to the language of the 14th Amendment. It talks about insurrection, right, and rebellion, those kinds of things. And the question then is whether it is self-implementing, self-executing. Here, you've got judges who are saying, as I've sometimes said on our broadcast here on Civic Media, there's a whole book full of federal criminal statutes, obviously civil as well, whole criminal statutes in all sorts of areas. I was thinking especially about for example, the statutes that require that there not be corruption, right, in public service. That could be one that could be invoked. And there was a very significant series of cases many years ago in which the Supreme Court came back and said under the mail fraud statute, you can't prosecute for something called honest services. That's just one example of the kinds of things, once again, that could be invoked. I don't even say bootstrapped, but there could be a relationship between those kinds of prosecutions. Typically, once again, it wouldn't be for violent crimes, although again, January 6th, plainly a violent incident, but other things of a white collar nature, things that go to corruption, as I indicated, things that go to financial fraud, document fraud, those kinds of things, where there is an attempt, perhaps, to undermine the very structure and constitution of our nation. Those kinds of things could be foreclosed. That's why we have lawyers. That's why in your family you've got many of them, Matt. And it does keep lawyers in business, right? And it does keep them always appropriately making arguments to courts about where the lines are drawn. And that's one of the other things that the language that you just cited is all about. Why should we restrict this? Why shouldn't we make it broad to ensure that in the future, if there is a situation where it strikes us as a pure matter of justice and rule of law, that this person should not escape or they should escape, one or the other, that argument cannot be had. Instead, we're going to cite to this case and Trump versus Anderson and say, nope, all of that is foreclosed. No option down the road. That's a difficult road to take.
Matt Rothschild here, subbing for Maggie Dawn and speaking with the great Jim Santel, former federal prosecutor and host of this show on legal issues. About pending litigation, usually at the U.S. Supreme Court, that really bring into question how much of a democracy we're actually going to have. What do you make? We talked about the three liberal justices in their concurring opinion, though it read like a dissent.
Right. Right.
Amy Coney Barrett, she went out of her way to break ranks with the five justices. It was an unsigned majority, unanimous opinion, but we don't know who wrote it at this point. She had a interesting kind of sometimes tart response in that she agreed with the liberals in that the majority went too far and answered questions that it didn't need to get to because once it had stipulated that there'd be chaos at the state level, that's all it had to answer and they could say goodbye. That would have been cleaner.
Absolutely.
But then she also kind of scolded the liberal justices for their rhetoric. Mm-hmm. What did you make of that whole thing?
Right, right. And so even from the oral argument, you had some shades of that. And I may be drawing too many lines, Matt, between the oral argument and what she wrote eventually. But she was very focused, along with some of the other justices as well, on the consequences of doing this. We just mentioned, for example, Colorado, Maine, Illinois, other places. And the concern that I think Amy Coney Barrett was identifying there in the oral argument was about the confusion, the patchwork of that. And I can tell you more about what I think, reading the tea leaves from Amy Coney Barrett in her language, what she's really focusing on, chiding, again, even the liberals with whom she agreed.
Yeah, we'll get to that right after this break. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show. Matt Rothschild here, subbing in for Maggie Dawn on Civic Media here, broadcasting out of the studios in Waukesha at the Shaw, 101 FM, 540 AM. I always listen to Civic Media when I'm in Madison on 92.7 FM.
And it's a good thing to do, right? Right.
We're statewide, and Civic Media is really providing a political lifeline for many of us here in this state. So I'm happy to be able to pitch hit for Maggie, who couldn't make it today. She'll be back tomorrow, and I'm just delighted to have in the studio with me Jim Santel, who's got a show on Civic Media on the weekends about all these legal challenges and the whole Trump challenge to our democracy. And he's here. We're going to continue to talk about the decision today, and I think we'll probably get to the immunity case,
yes,
too, but we're talking about the decision about the insurrection clause of the 14th Amendment and the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, unanimous one to say you can't kick Trump off the ballot state by state. States can't do it.
Exactly, right. And so right before the break, you and I were chatting, Matt, about Amy Coney Barrett, who kind of occupies this middle ground, if you will. She is certainly not a swing vote in any way because, again, you got a unanimous decision here. But as we indicated before, we've got the three liberals whose language is pretty strong. They're saying you have done this wrong, the other five. And she comes back and she says, yes, I agree. that the other five are going down a road they don't have to go down. But she also, as you indicated, chides the liberals with whom she also sort of concurs here and says your language is too much. And it goes on to say what I will describe this afternoon as being sort of the can't we all get along kind of approach to things. Right. She says she's urging the public, as you said, Matt, to focus on common ground. She says this: for present purposes, our differences, even though she's got them with the other five, with the other three, are less important than our unanimity. All nine justices agree on the outcome of this case. That is the message Americans should take home. And indeed it is. She is right about that. Even so, as we parse through this, we have a situation where you've got judges who have different views about their authority and what they should be doing. I think she is making the point, as are the other three, that we're not legislators. We're not the ones across the parking lot at Capitol Hill there who should be making these calls. We're not the ones. We shouldn't be telling them what to do. We interpret the Constitution, as we said in our previous discussion, Matt. We should interpret in a way that gives latitude for further exposition. Judges decide cases that are before them, and that's what we have done here. Donald Trump remains on the ballot there, and presumably again in all the other states where this is being challenged. And then she's also looking shades of her oral argument questions when she was asking about the effect that this would have. You have a patchwork. If you do have Maine and Illinois and Wisconsin and Colorado, all sorts of other states out there, California went in the opposite direction, right? They kept Donald Trump on the ballot. What happens there? And she was, again, it was sort of that sense of unanimity, even among states, even though we're all different, and asking, isn't that something that we should be concerned about as a Supreme Court? We're not responsible. We're not an election commission. They should also not be involved in politics. There's this thing called the political doctrine, questions doctrine. Judges, justices traditionally don't get involved in those kinds of things. But her view is broader. And she says, you know what? The message today is a unanimity on this particular issue. Everybody should know, regardless of what side of the political aisle you're on, that Donald Trump should be on the ballot. And that is the decision of all of us. That's just an important thing to say. 9-0 opinions are significant. They're compelling statements to America.
And she also recognized that this was a highly partisan case.
Absolutely.
She doesn't have her head in the sand. And in fact, you know, I'm surprised because when Trump appointed her and she got confirmed, I thought she was going to be in the Alito, Clarence Thomas camp, right. And she right. doesn't appear to be. She seems to be with the Chief Justice, kind of in the middle, and further to the center than the far right other justices.
Absolutely, there's always surprises. The history of the Supreme Court has been appointments typically of so-called conservative justices. When they become members of the Supreme Court, they take on that black robe, lifetime tenure there. They tend to drift more toward the middle centrist. John Paul Stevens, again from the Seventh Circuit, like Amy Coney Barrett, a very good example of that, appointed by Gerald Ford, regarded as a conservative justice, becomes one of the most liberal justices.
Here's a little family secret.
Yeah, very good.
My father, I told you, was a lawyer. He practiced law with John Paul Stevens in
there
Chicago.
There you go. There you go. And so he knows well. I'm sure there are reports in the journals of the family, right, that talk about that. And Amy Coney Barrett, again, is one of those people, certainly on that side of the political aisle, and not a good side, a bad side, just typically on that side. And again, as you and I have talked before, I don't especially like the notion of labeling justices liberal or conservative, because very often they surprise us and they do not go in that direction. And so she has been a justice a bit more of a centrist, certainly with John Roberts. The other one I'll put out there is Brett Kavanaugh. And we've got a voting rights case from last term where he joined, again, the so-called liberals and the Chief Justice and Amy Coney Barrett in finding that Alabama had engaged in a Voting Rights Act violation. So we've got other cases out there where she is a bit more in the center. And here again, I think she is very much saw her role as wanting to send this message of something in the center here. The decision is clear, but the center is what America should understand.
I also think it may be a foreshadowing of where she wants the court to go in the big immunity case coming up, which we'll get to beyond the break. But we have a caller waiting. I think we should take a caller. Joelle is on the line. No, she's not there.
Take Mark from the SAC.
All right, we can take Mark from the SAC.
Thanks so much for taking my call. I'm continuing to hold my argument on this issue because as I've talked to Jim many times on this issue, that I think the insurrection actually started, you know, before the last election in 2020, you know, at least the planning for it. And I'd maintain that there's actually two parts of the 14th Amendment that should have been considered here, and I guess they can't because it wasn't brought forth in arguments. But I'd maintain that the fake electors plot was a clear violation of Section 2 of the 14th Amendment, which guarantees citizens the right to select the electors. Not anybody else. It's supposed to be the citizens selecting the electors. The only part that I'm a little confused in is what the penalty on that part of it is. But it's clear that the 14th Amendment, Section 3, should be self-executing because the language in it, to me, suggests it is self-executing. And the actual removal of the impediment to run for office, that is in the hands of the Congress by a two-thirds majority in both houses, you know, voting in the affirmative to remove the impediment to the person seeking office.
Mark, so I hear you on both of those. I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court didn't say today that it was self-executing, said the opposite. But I'm going to throw this to Jim Santel to see what he says about the voting rights implications violations, which could be nestled in the 14th Amendment or other statutes.
Absolutely. And I think Mark and has a good point here, which is we don't spend a lot of time in the history of America looking at Section 3. We haven't had to do that. But the big language there, of course, Section 1, Section 2, that is all about voting, right? Equal protection and due process, all those kinds of things. And states can't deny those rights to people, including the right to vote. That's also been implemented by legislation, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and other subsequent cases invoking that and interpreting that by the Supreme Court. And so the argument, I think, that Mark is making here is about this other aspect of the so-called insurrection, the attempt to interfere with the election in 2020, which is the fake electors issue. We know that there are state court prosecutors who are prosecuting that, and they may invoke that portion of the 14th Amendment.
Thanks, Jim Santel. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm subbing in for Maggie Dawn, who will be back tomorrow. Thanks, Mark, for the call. You can call, too, 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-752-4842. We'll come back, talk about that immunity case. Keep on rocking me, baby, baby, baby. Keep on rocking me, baby. Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm not Maggie Dawn. I'm Matt Rothschild. Maggie is out today. She'll be back tomorrow. I'm the former editor at the Progressive Magazine and former executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Out of retirement for today's show, happy to be able to pitch hit, and even happier still to be in studio with Jim Santel, who's got a terrific show on civic media on the weekends about just the subjects we've been talking about today. This question of our democracy, our legal scaffolding, the challenges, legal and illegal, that Donald Trump has posed to that democracy. And so we're going to be talking about the immunity case that is still pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. This, to my mind, is the big case.
Yes.
And I'm very frustrated. Mm-hmm. I'm very frustrated that Merrick Garland took so long to get Jack Smith in place.
Right.
Because the calendar wouldn't be so messed up and crushed right mm-hmm. now. And I'm upset that the U.S. Supreme Court didn't simply accept the terrific decision by the appellate court, which laid out in really excruciating detail why we can't have a president who's above the law. Why did the U.S. Supreme Court not just say, look, well, the appellate court has answered this question sufficiently. Right. We don't need to take this.
Right. Nothing more to decide here. And Matt, to your very good point, if your listeners want to take a look at that, maybe they're not going to be interrupting more important things with family and business today, but take a look at that Court of Appeals opinion. It is compelling. It is decisive. Take a look at Tanya Chutkan's initial, the original order on this case. Also, she is saying presidents are not kings. We abandoned that sometime around 1776 and forward, and certainly by 1787. We don't have that system anymore. Those are compelling pieces of jurisprudential writing. And typically, how does the Supreme Court get involved? They do a couple of things. One is, if there's a split in the circuits, if the Fifth Circuit is saying one thing, the Seventh Circuit is another, they will get together and they have to resolve that. Or if there's really a compelling issue in the environment, education, commerce, those kinds of things, voting rights, that has to be resolved and is not, they will do that. This is neither one of those. There's no split out there. Nobody is looking at this. And I will go even beyond what you have very diplomatically said today. And I will say that this is a frivolous argument. This is a frivolous argument that the President of the United States of America today, in the past, in the future, has immunity. If they would happen to go in the opposite direction, this is the end of the Republic. It is the basis upon which our Constitution was put together. We've got an Article 1, which is the legislature. We've got an Article 2, which is the executive branch, Article 3, the judiciary. The whole concept behind there is checks and balances.
Well, and if you're listening and you think that's hyperbole, check this out. One of Trump's lawyers at oral argument said that, was asked whether Trump, as president, could use the military to go kill his opponent. And Trump's lawyer said, just kind of fudged it, wanted to deny that that was a possibility or could be okay.
Right. Invoking all kinds of things. We've heard about the Insurrections Act being invoked again to bring tanks down the streets of cities that are arguably run by people that the president doesn't care for, those kinds of things. You can't have, it simply cannot be, the sun rises in the West. And right now we're anticipating, and I will get back to our previous discussion, Matt. This is another one. We'll talk about when it comes out next, I suspect. This is another one that needs to be 9-0. We need to have 9 Supreme Court justices, every single one of them, left, right, middle, wherever they may fall. Everyone has got to come forward and say, you know what? There is no such thing as presidential immunity for criminal conduct done while you are in office. That is that's the Federalist Papers. That's James Madison. That's so basic to our notion of our democracy, our republic, that if they go in the opposite direction, all bets are off. Mm. And that's the reason why I'd like to think, even if it's not unanimous, it should be. But even if it's not unanimous, the Supreme Court will the majority of the Supreme Court, among them, again, maybe the Amy Coney Barretts and the John Robertses and maybe even the Brett Kavanaughs will come forward and say, yes, indeed, this argument has no merit. The difficulty, as you just hinted, is all about timing and the fact that this has been pending now. They had a couple of options here to remedy this early on. You may recall Jack Smith asked them to take this up, to leapfrog over the D.C. Court of Appeals. They said, nope. Well, we're going to leave that at the lower court.
Why I thought they were going to just accept the appellate decision.
Exactly. That gives a lot of people some reason to believe that that would be the remedy here. They didn't do that. A petition for what's called a writ of certiorari, which is the request from the Donald Trump folks to have this reviewed, that they move fairly quickly along. Jack Smith says, nope, no reason to review this for the reasons that you and I, Matt, just described. And the Supreme Court, to my mind, stunningly says yes. Not only stunningly says yes, but puts this not on an especially fast track. They could have also done this. They could have said, you know what, Donald Trump attorneys, you file your brief in 5 days, Jack Smith 5 days after that. And 5 days after that, we're going to have oral argument. We're going to get this done within a month. This is now on for April 22nd, not this month, not next month, middle of next month, and which means we're going to be talking about this, you and I, Matt, in June.
Yeah.
In June. This is coming out in June.
And do you think this was just crass political or they're going for they're letting their guy off the hook? Is that what they're doing?
It certainly seems that way. I will give them this. It may well be that you've got a majority of the Supreme Court justices on both sides of the aisle who said, you know what, we want to be heard on this for history. Maybe they want to write about this, be dispositive about this so that our children, grandchildren are looking back and looking at Trump versus U.S. and saying, no, this was resolved back in 2024. Maybe for history, John Roberts wants to go on record saying this. But for the history of this nation right now, all they needed to do was to deny that writ. They could have done that last week, which they didn't do. What happens then? The law of the case is the D.C. opinion. The D.C. opinion then permits Tanya Chutkan, frankly, could have happened last week, to begin to reschedule the trial. Now, she can't put it right back on her docket. It's not the day after, nor will she be able to do this after the Supreme Court decides this case in June. Let's suppose on June 10th they come up with an opinion, hopefully unanimously, maybe just a majority that says, no such thing as immunity. Tanya Chutkan does not have the capacity on June 11th to begin jury selection. She's got to call everybody back in. She's got to find a 2-month block of time, maybe more, in her calendar. We are looking at launch. She'd already talked about an 88-day period of time she wanted to give Donald Trump and all the parties a permission and authority, a significant period of time to prepare for the case. We are looking at best, into a fall trial. Would be right up against the election. And there is a non-frivolous argument to be made that this case will not even begin until after the election because of what they did.
That's just crushing. Jim Santelli, you're making me sick.
You invited me on, right?
Yeah, that's right. Not good news for any of us who wants to see justice
that's
done.
That's exactly it.
There's that saying about justice denied not being justice. And this is justice being certainly delayed to the point of not being done. And voters aren't getting it right. As Todd Albaugh said in the previous show, his great show on civic media, that Liz Cheney was saying that voters deserve to know whether the president violated the law. I think the record is clear, but it'd be nice to get the U.S. Supreme Court.
It means something, right? It means something to people, Matt. Right about your point is if you've got a jury of your peers who look at the evidence, this is not Joe Biden, this is not Jack Smith, this is not Donald Trump's lawyers, who come forward and say beyond a reasonable doubt, we have unanimously found that these counts, these charges are supported by the evidence and this person will be convicted. That's a compelling finding in the jurisprudence of our nation, in the history of our nation as well. And as you know, as you've talked about before, Matt, polls right now indicate that there are people out there who are waiting to see whether there is a criminal conviction that will impact their vote. Under those circumstances, again, the Supreme Court very easily could have said nothing to decide here. There isn't anything to decide here and move this along.
Yeah, we deserve to know as voters in a democracy. Jim Santel, I have a question about how the U.S. Supreme Court has put this issue on the table. They said we're going to decide whether the president has immunity for official acts. Well, that raises the whole question is what's an official act and what's an unofficial act, like overturning an election with corrupt means?
Right, exactly. And so we're opening up that door now, too, to talk about the language of what is official, what isn't. We saw a little shade of this with the E. Jean Carroll matter, right? This is the defamation case, the woman who now has gotten two separate jury judgments against Donald Trump, finding that he did, in fact, sexually assault her and then went on to defame her while he was in office. Early on, believe it or not, the United States Department of Justice said that he was talking not in his official capacity, which stunned me. And I think all kinds of other civil chiefs out there said, what? That can't possibly be. The Department of Justice eventually reversed its course and these cases went forward. But now we've got that issue opened a little bit, too. And the determination about what is official, what isn't, plainly not everything, every single thing that a president does every single moment of every day is in an official capacity. But certainly the big things, the things we look to in terms of execution of the Article 2 powers, that's got to be right in the core of this. And so as they look now to general immunity issues, I hope that they focus on that fundamental notion, broadly speaking. There is not presidential immunity here. We don't have to parse into issues of civil liability and other things out there. Let's make this as clear as it can be, as clear as the opinion today is on the Colorado case.
Speaking with Jim Santel, who has got a great show on civic media on the weekends, he is a former federal prosecutor. Mm-hmm. He knows what he's talking about here. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm subbing in for Maggie Dawn. I'm the former editor of The Progressive and used to work at the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. So thanks for listening. We'll take a call. Bob's been waiting a long time. Should we get Bob in here? Calvin? Calvin's our engineer and producer, doing a great job and helped me out a lot.
Hello?
Yes, Bob, you're on.
Oh, okay, yeah. Recusal is the thing that smacks me right in the face on both of these decisions, both the insurrection and the immunity. It seems like they have an obvious conflict of interest. Three of them were appointed by Trump to decide a Trump case is a clear conflict of interest. Why aren't they recusing themselves, those three, and probably the fourth one, because Jenny Thomas was an active insurrectionist. She clearly compromised her husband. So there should be four recusals. In which case it becomes a 3-2 liberal majority court.
Well, thanks, Bob. I really appreciate the call and the comment. I was going to ask Jim Santel about Clarence Thomas and his particular situation here vis-a-vis his wife's involvement in the insurrection. I'll throw it over to you, Jim.
Absolutely. So I think Bob's got it just right on that piece. And that is that, what is a conflict of interest? You've got two interests. One of them is as a Supreme Court justice deciding cases on behalf of the people of America, under the Constitution, the laws of our government. And then you've also got another interest, which is that of your household and your spouse, right? And that's the concern, I think, that we and Bob are articulating here. You've got your spouse, who presumably is not only involved in these issues, but arguably making money off of them and bringing income into the very household of which you are a part. And then you're going to work and you're deciding a case or cases. We've seen this in the past. Clarence Thomas has participated in other decisions already having to do with investigations, enforcement of subpoenas. You are now deciding matters that have an impact upon the very thing that your wife, your spouse, is also engaged in professionally. Can she do that? Absolutely. She's got a right to have her own life apart from her husband. But that means that when it comes to his decision-making, recusal had to happen in those other cases. I agree entirely. We've got, again, we're way beyond our focus of our discussion today, Matt, but we got this thing in Georgia where, again, there's an allegation of a conflict of interest. There isn't a conflict of interest because there's a symmetry of interest. You don't have Fani Willis there on the one hand prosecuting a case and having something else out there that conflicts with her commitment to the law and to prosecution initiatives.
But it was really stupid of her, though, just
absolutely.
As far as appearances go.
Absolutely. Appearances is a very different thing. A personnel matter of huge importance. You bet it is. An HR issue. I'm hoping that the judge in that case will parse through that under Georgia law, find there's not a conflict of interest, even though there's a lot of work that's got to be done inside that office to clean this up. I agree with you entirely. It simply isn't the basis for getting her off the case. There's not a conflict in which you can identify two interests that are truly opposing each other.
Yeah, I think she's going to be able to stay on that case. I watched a lot of the testimony, right, including hers and her dad's. Both of whom I thought were quite compelling.
Yes, absolutely. And again, as you can tell from the force and the power of her testimony, how strongly she feels about this, I'm hoping that Scott McAfee is again engaging in this so that Donald Trump cannot come back and say on that issue, in the Georgia case, he wasn't given his day in court. This judge has given his day in court and more. I can't remember a whole lot of circumstances in my own history where a judge would give you all this evidentiary time to go down this road.
Yeah. Well, we'll be back, and here's a tease. We'll have CJ on the line when we come back. We'll talk to CJ.
Very good.
You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm Matt Rothschild, pitch hitting for Maggie today, and I'm here with Jim Santel. You might use it if you feel better. When you get home, Ricky, don't lose that number. Ricky, don't lose that number. Ricky, don't lose that number. Back with Matt Rothschild here, subbing in for Maggie Dawn. He'll be in studio tomorrow. I'm here with Jim Santel, former federal prosecutor and host on Civic Media on the weekends of a great show on the legal challenges in the courts that have profound implications for our democracy. I've been listening to him pretty faithfully over the years, and I think it's one of the best shows on all of radio, one of the most informative shows there is out there.
That's very gracious of you.
I run into friends who say, who is that lawyer who's telling me all this
stuff?
Who's
that guy who drones on insufferably on Saturday mornings, right?
So, as I said, we will hear from CJ, who calls in from time to time.
Great.
CJ, what's on your mind today?
Gentlemen.
How are you? Thanks for holding so long.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. I called Mr. Cannoli many times, and actually for you gentlemen to finally take my call, I'd like to ask him one question because he, the 51 former intelligence officers that lied about Trump, we now know that. I'm curious, does he know any of those gentlemen? Because I've never heard him speak about those 51 that lied to over 300 million Americans.
CJ, I don't know what you're talking about, unfortunately.
Nor do I, CJ. I need to have you tell me a little bit more about that. We know that, frankly, we know about a recent informant for the FBI who was recently indicted for lying about Joe Biden and Hunter Biden, and that's a matter of an indictment. I'm not familiar with this particular story.
Well, the New York Post, it all started about the lie and the cover-up and the money that has gone to social media. But today's, thank God, all of the justices saw this for what it is. I don't recall Special Counsel Jack Smith charging President Trump with insurrection.
He did not. Gentlemen? You're right. CJ, I think CJ is,
thanks for the call, CJ. Yep. CJ raised an interesting point
yes,
there.
Yes, yes.
Because when I'm talking with friends on this case, whether the 14th Amendment applies, I do think Trump also had a due process case to present in that he wasn't charged or convicted of being an insurrectionist. So how could he be, disappear from a ballot, taken off a ballot because he was an insurrectionist? I know the judges in Colorado ruled him to be an insurrectionist. I believe his actions constitute insurrection in a common sense definition of the word, but there's a statute about insurrection. Yep. He wasn't charged.
He was not charged with that.
Nor convicted.
He is not charged with that. He is not charged for things related to the statements on the ellipse, right? Jack Smith, I think appropriately, stayed away from that issue and instead has charged him again with these conspiracies having to do with the proceedings before in a government, right? And again, one of those statutes, also the subject of another Supreme Court case that's out there. But CJ, you're absolutely right that there was not, and nor will there be, under the present description of the charges federally against him, an insurrection judgment.
Do you think that was a mistake by Jack Smith?
I do not. I think what Jack Smith did, he obviously charged this in a very lean way. He charges one defendant. He identifies six or seven other unindicted co-conspirators and charges four counts. He limits this in a way that again, unlike the Fannie Willis indictment, which is this huge sprawling RICO indictment, a very different approach, Jack Smith decides to go lean. And that's a decision that, frankly, inside the federal government we often make. We're not going to put all of this into an indictment or present it to the grand jury. And that makes the trial easier, not just because of an evidentiary presentation, but for juries to understand. And that's with great respect for juries. It also ensures some integrity of the process itself and also gets to the meat of the argument. And I do think the indictment against Donald Trump describes accurately what the allegations are.
Kind of wish Fannie Willis had gone lean, too.
Right.
We've got a call. We've got Joe on the line who often calls with very thoughtful questions. So I wanted to take her call.
Great.
Hello.
Hi, Joe. You're on.
Hey, hi. Thanks again. I agree with you, Matt. Jim's show is certainly one of the best and really a resource for people. Definitely check it out. And great to hear your voice again and anxious to get your thoughts of both of you to my point. Within this decision that came down today, Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett said that in her opinion that her thoughts that it was that the nation's temperature needs to be brought down, and that's part of the job of the Supreme Court is to take down the nation's temperature. I was just flabbergasted when I saw that. I mean, this is a court that she signed on for the Dobbs decision, which overthrew 50 years of established precedents. How does that drop the nation's temperature? And how do really important cases like Brown v. Brown, or Brown versus the Board of Education, the one that went to integration of our schools, that certainly didn't take the temperature down for the nation, but it was an important thing to do. I do not understand why that would be the court's job. I think the court's job is to look at the law. What about taking down the national temperature? What is that? I just thought that was the most gratuitous who do you think you are kind of statement, because what I don't know your thoughts. What do you think, guys?
Well, thanks, Joe. I love the question. I'm going to kick it over to Jim.
Absolutely. And Joe, as always, thank you, number one, for the very nice comments about the show. And frankly, I wish you would commit that to a law review article, because that's exactly right. We talked before about the Constitution. Article 3 of the Constitution describes what justices should be doing. And turning the temperature up or down in the nation's history and our present status, you can make the compelling argument that that's a political thing to do, right? That's the legislature. They may do that. The executive branch may do that. I could not describe it more more precisely than you just have, Joe. The role of justices and of judges, both federal and state, is to decide what the law is, to apply the facts to the law and come to a judgment. I will tell you, over the course of the 35, almost 40 years that I practiced, there are many times when I am given a judgment on behalf of a client, both the government and even individual clients, and you think, well, you know what? This is legally proper. This is premised upon the facts. The judge has done a good job of analyzing this. This is not playing to another forum out there. This is not playing to the evening news. This is not turning the temperature up and down. Could not agree more. That's not within the role of justices, even though I tend to agree somewhat on obviously her view generally about the exclusive nature of the non-exclusive nature of the 14th Amendment, Section 3.
Yeah, I mean, I think she was not only scolding the three liberal justices, but also issuing a warning to her far right-wing colleagues, right. Especially when it comes to this immunity case, that they should understand that there is a really volatile political climate out there, that the U.S. Supreme Court should, if at all possible, as you've been saying, Jim, on this show and on your show, reach a unanimous decision. Right. For the health of the country, and just wanted to encourage people to calm down and try not to contribute to the hyper-partisanship and ugliness that we see all over this country right now. Jim, it's the end of the program. I want to thank you for being on the show. It's been a real pleasure to have you. We could talk for hours.
We could. Pleasure is all mine, Matt. Thanks so much for having me on this afternoon.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Maggie Dawn Show. Maggie's not here, obviously.